The law should be that you do not get to bill somebody else for your misconduct if you're a for-profit entity like NSTAR.
New legislation targets an NSTAR mistake that's costing customers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 7th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Seldovia couple finds a launching pad to fame.
We've actually had an inquiry from the Oprah Winfrey Show, which is very tentative at this point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
A bill ready to be introduced to the legislature tomorrow for consideration this year would prevent utilities from billing customers for losses due to the company's own negligence, recklessness, or violation of the law. It is a response to NSTAR Natural Gas Company's decision to charge customers for the money it needed to reimburse Fort Richardson after discovering a $6 million billing error. Anchorage's Bill Wilikowski, sponsor of the Senate version of the bill, says the measure only puts into law what should be common sense.
This is something that is so understood all throughout the state of Alaska, all throughout the entire country.
The rate increase is now before the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, although NSTAR has been allowed an interim rate increase until a final decision is made. Wilikowski says with the bill, the company would not have been granted that temporary permission. Les Guerra, one of the sponsors of the House version of the bill, says legislators may hope that current state statutes would prevent this type of thing, but he says NSTAR has argued the issue before the commission and is already billing the public for its error.
And that's the dispute that's going before the RCA right now, is NSTAR's attorneys say that no matter the misconduct, they get to bill the public. We're saying that if the RCA's attorneys are right, we need to fix the law. And in any case, it never hurts to clarify the law. And the law should be that you do not get to bill somebody else for your misconduct if you're a for-profit entity like NSTAR.
NSTAR spokesman John Sims says the company sees the bill as an inappropriate attempt to influence a decision pending before the Regulatory Commission. He says that decision was delayed by the commission, originally set for last Friday. It is now expected March 1st. Another legislative bill already under scrutiny would have wide-ranging effects for state residents on public assistance. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Wasilla Representative Wes Keller has already filed one bill that will surely cause debate.
So what the bill does is it merely tells the Department of Health and Social Services and sets up some people in that department to have the option of doing a random or suspicion-based test on somebody that is asking for public assistance.
Keller says the measure is not aimed at punishing those on public assistance, but he says substance abuse is a contributing factor in suicides, crime, and domestic violence and child abuse.
The intent is not necessarily to remove the public assistance. It's not intended to cut down the cost or the money going out for public assistance. It's to give the department a tool to be able to deal with what is often the real underlying cause of so many tough situation.
Keller says some details of the bill have yet to be worked out. He says if one member of a family on assistance is found to be a drug abuser, it would be up to the Department of Health and Social Services to determine the next move. HSS may have the power to curtail assistance to that family, he says. Wilda Laughlin is a legislative liaison with HSS. She says the idea has been tried in other states but has faced legal challenges.
The bill also requires that the department implements the program and that we adopt testing policies and that we pay for the cost of testing and the cost of transportation to and from the testing center. So we do know that there will be a fiscal impact, but we don't know exactly what that will be until later in the process. But we are concerned about the fiscal impact.
Laughlin was not able to exactly describe the legal challenges the bill may face. She says HSS's legal analysis of the bill is not complete. Keller says the costs for the drug tests have yet to be determined. He says the bill gives HHS the go-ahead to direct drug abusers into a treatment program.
The problem we have, of course, is that when we provide public assistance, especially in the form of money, without looking into, you know, how that is being spent, it can actually, you know, increase the problem, you know, that's related to the substance abuse.
Keller says his intent is to enable HHS to assign a number to the amount of drug users on public assistance. He says the bill is valuable if it ultimately causes Alaskans to become healthy individuals. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Charter boat owners are floating a pair of proposals that would further reduce the commercial halibut catch. Longliners say the plans would put them out of business. The proposals go before the International Pacific Halibut Commission later this month. It's the latest salvo in a years-long battle over flatfish allocations that's focused on southeast waters. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Businesses that take sport anglers out to hook halibut are watching their share of the harvest shrink. They've seen two flatfish per angler per day catch limits cut in half, and they're facing a limited entry system that will significantly reduce the number of charter boats on the water. Now they're proposing two plans that would cut the commercial catch, but they say it's about conservation, not retribution.
We just want to see the system corrected to help ensure that the stocks do rebound.
Richard Yamada is a Juneau Lodge owner and board member of the Alaska Charter Association. His group and a similar organization called the Charter Halibut Task Force recently submitted two proposals to the International Pacific Halibut Commission. That's the regulatory body that oversees stocks in waters off Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, and British Columbia. Those stocks have been shrinking, particularly in southeast.
I guess the finger's been pointing to us as being the major culprits of this, but we take such a small percentage of the fish in the first place, around 15%, that any overages in our catch that is recommended is minuscule compared to the overages in the commercial fleet.
Longliners get a far larger share of the fishery, though they've seen it significantly reduced in the past 5 or so years. Charter fishermen have seen their catch jump, though part of the increase has been above regulatory limits. One of the Charter Association's proposals would suspend a regulatory mechanism that slowly increases commercial allocations when fish populations are up and quickly reduces them when they're down. The charter group's Yamada says what's called slow up, fast down unfairly boosts longliners' catch for economic, not scientific, reasons.
Instead of taking the staff recommendation as to what would be a recommended catch level, the IPAC takes this level and gives them additional fish to buffer that impact to the commercial setline fleet.
I guess what's important is that it's not supported by the science.
Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association Director Linda Benkin says the proposal would remove an important regulatory practice that protects halibut stocks. She says it would also force the catch limit so low that regulators would not allow longliners to harvest.
What the charter guys are, you know, in essence trying to do is shift the whole burden for conserving the resource on the commercial fishermen by shutting down the commercial fishery and asking that their allocation be set based on their previous year's harvest rather than based on their established allocation.
The second proposal asks the Halibut Commission to resume basing their allocations on data from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. 3 years ago, the commission established a separate system for setting charter harvest levels. Regulators say the system reined in out-of-control growth, but lodge owners and other operators say those limits have given commercial fishermen more flatfish. Benkin says the current system works fine, and it's time for lodge and other charter operators to get in touch with reality.
I guess all of us keep hoping that they will at some point recognize that all commercial harvesters, whether they're longliners or charter operators, have to live within the limits of the resource. And when stocks are down, you conserve. You don't try and shift that burden onto someone else and continue to overharvest yourself.
The charter group's proposals mostly address southeast and south-central Alaska fisheries, known as Areas 2C and 3A, but could have wider impacts. They go before the International Pacific Halibut Commission at a meeting in Seattle, January 26th through 29th. IPHC Executive Director Bruce Lehman would not comment on the plans. I'm Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Shell Oil Company has cleared another hurdle in its quest to explore for oil off Alaska's northwest coast. Alaska Senator Mark Begich said on Thursday that the Environmental Protection Agency issued a draft air quality permit for Shell's exploration in the Chukchi Sea. The permit is one of the last administrative steps needed before final approval for drilling in the Chukchi is granted. Shell plans on having up to 3 exploratory wells operating in the Chukchi next summer. The company proposes exploratory drilling in open water using a 500-foot drill ship, an ice management vessel, an ice-class anchor handling vessel, and oil spill response vessels. A public comment period on the matter ends February 17th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, unusual conditions for the start of the Copper Basin 300.
I can't remember a race where the temperatures have been this warm. I mean, usually we're in the 20, 30, 40 below range.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com.
Two Anchorage area Alaskan educators were honored at the White House yesterday for their work as science and math teachers. Laura Ann Hulsbus of Eagle River and Cheryl Silcox, formerly of White Mountain, were selected as recipients of the Presidential Award for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching. Hulsbus has taught math to special education students in grades 4 through 6 in Eagle River since 2006. Silcox now teaches at the Winterberry Charter Waldorf School in the Anchorage School District. She taught school in rural Alaska for 16 years. The award comes with a $10,000 prize from the National Science Foundation. President Obama was on hand for yesterday's award ceremony. The Presidential Award for Excellence in Mathematics and Science Teaching is given out annually to educators from around the country. A national trend of adding video games to public library collections took root in Juneau in early 2009, which followed similar additions in Fairbanks and Anchorage middle schools. As Jeremy Shea reports from Juneau, library officials say the oft-demonized medium is welcome.
Many of Alaska's gamers have a new venue to pursue their interest, public libraries. The American Library Association has taken the stance that adding video games is consistent with the mission of public libraries. It's caught on in Juneau and Fairbanks public library systems and in Anchorage middle school libraries. ALA officials say that's in line with the national trend over the last 5 years. Jenny Levine is the association's emerging technology expert. She says it's a natural extension of having board games and other social gaming activities at the library.
For a long time, libraries have had Clue and Scrabble and Life and board games like that. But what's changed over the last few years is that gaming has become more social, and it's been most visible with video games. You get things like the Nintendo Wii, Rock Band, Mario Kart, where it's fun for everybody to watch, not just play. And so that has changed the dynamic of gaming in libraries.
Juneau's downtown library was one of about 1,300 to participate in the second annual National Gaming Day in November that Levine coordinated.
You know, everybody has the stereotype of the 1950s library that you go there to sit and read in quiet, and that's not really what libraries are about anymore, although it's still a piece. This was a chance to say, hey, you know, you can go have a fun social experience at the library as well and, you know, play with people in your community that you don't normally meet, let alone play with.
Levine says game selection should be based on the library's community goals. For example, Friends of Juneau Public Library's president Ray Bennett says his nonprofit spent about $2,500 on the video game collection last year to attract youth, help financially disadvantaged kids have access to games, and in the process create interest in other library offerings.
We did discuss it, and we said, well, that's new, and what was the reasoning for it? And we listened to library staff, and we felt unanimous in supporting the proposal, so that's why we did it.
Juneau's 51 Xbox 360, Nintendo Wii, and PlayStation 3 titles for loan are a popular subset of the library's roughly 100,000 items. The downtown branch also has a Wii console it uses for occasional after-hours library gaming nights. Fairbanks Library Director Greg Hill says about three-quarters of its 439 game collection is out at any given time.
It's a strong entertainment medium, and we have a lot of entertainment mediums here. You know, a lot of people in their 20s and 30s think that libraries are just like they were back when they were kids, and we've changed a lot. So we like to get the word out. One way of doing that is to have a collection that would be real popular that would draw people in.
The Fairbanks video game collection was seeded with money from fundraisers and donations in 2006 and has since become a regular taxpayer-funded budget item. Both Juno and Fairbanks game titles range from family-friendly E to the violent M, content ratings similar to the movie industry's G and R ratings. Neither city enforces age restriction policies on borrowing games or other library content. Video games have not come to the state's largest public library system. Anchorage Collection Development Coordinator Laura Baldwin says she'd like to add them, but doesn't have the money, especially after a recent budget cut.
Once you bring a new collection in, demand grows to meet that collection, and I can't meet that demand under current budget structure.
While video games sometimes fuel headlines with controversial content or possible deleterious effects, Levine says adding games to library collections only occasionally raises eyebrows and is largely uncontroversial.
Yeah, I have had people say to me, no, libraries should be spending money on books. And, you know, libraries change with the times. We've added music, we've added movies, gaming is just another format. It's just another container for entertainment and information.
For more on gaming and libraries, visit the ALA's website, librarygamingtoolkit.org, or follow Liz Danforth's gaming blog at librarygeournal.com. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration scientists will be working with a new tool to track fish in southeast Alaska this spring. In April, scientists at NOAA's Auk Bay Laboratories in Juneau plan to use an autonomous underwater vehicle, or AUV, capable of detecting and recording tagged fish at various depths. The torpedo-shaped submersible can be programmed to operate independently for more than 12 hours. Research biologist John Eiler hopes it'll give scientists a better idea of fish behavior than the typical method of tracking fish, which involves using acoustic receivers attached to surface-based vessels or buoys.
The problem with both those methods is with the acoustic curtain, you know, the fish have to behave themselves. They have to travel and come into contact with that curtain of buoys. But oftentimes fish do things we don't expect.
Another benefit of the AUV is its ability to collect environmental data, including current speeds, water temperature, salinity, oxygen concentrations, and chlorophyll levels. It also has a side-scan sonar to record images of the ocean floor. Eiler says that will give scientists a better sense of the areas fish are using.
It's very important to get a sense of how fish are distributed, their movement patterns, particularly not only within a season but between seasons, the types of areas that they're using, which areas are important. And this is becoming additionally important with changes in ocean conditions to see how changes may be affecting some of these patterns.
Initially, the scientists will be tracking about 20 tagged fish, including rockfish, halibut, sablefish, pollock, herring, and crab. They'll be comparing data collected from the AUV to traditional means of tracking fish. Eiler says if it's successful, they could expand their use in the future.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
The season's first big mid-distance sled dog race gets underway Saturday in Glen Allen. 35 mushers are signed up so far for the Copper Basin 300, including defending champion Lance Mackey of Fairbanks, 1995 winner Jeff King of Denali Park, and three-time past champion Alan Moore of Two Rivers. Race board president Marty Karjala expects the field to reach 40 as running conditions look good.
We've got the entire trail in, and I've been helping with this race for 8 years, and I can't remember a race where the temperatures have been this warm. I mean, usually we're in the 20, 30, 40 below range, and this year it looks like we're going to be above zero, so it'll be interesting. It's going to be a fun race.
Karjala says warm temperatures may make for more overflow, but that otherwise conditions along the notoriously tough 300-mile route look better than usual. The Copper Basin is an Iditarod and Yukon Quest qualifier and testing ground for mushers aiming for the longer events, but Karjala says the race's significance has increased.
For the past couple of years, really, we've been the only mid-distance race in Alaska that's had a trail. It hasn't always been the best trail, but like the Cusco, you know, they get washed out up there. Other races have to cancel because of lack of snow. So we've been consistent.
Copper Basin 300 organizers have made some changes in the race trail for 2010. The race will be run in the opposite direction, and some sections of the trail have been rerouted. Karjala says the changes are aimed at shaking up the event, which has been dominated by Lance Mackey and Alan Moore for the last 5 years.
The mushers, you know, they need to replan their strategies because, you know, some of these veterans that have been running this race for years, now we've switched up the course for them. So we're just trying to put a little bit of thinking there for them. So it kind of evens the playing field because now they've got to re-strategize how they're going to do their breaks and how they're just going to do this race.
The race starts in Glen Allen Saturday morning and finishes at Tulsana Lake Resort. Mushers have to take a total of 18 hours rest. A finisher is expected sometime Monday. Brett Higman and Aaron McKittrick might become Seldovia's most famous residents. The couple, who live in a yurt off Jackaloff Bay Road with their 11-month-old baby, were the subject last week of a New York Times feature article on rustic living. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has the story.
The article, entitled Broadband Yes, Toilet No, was an instant sensation, climbing to the top of the New York Times' most emailed list and setting off an onslaught of media inquiries from as far away as Columbia. Higman, who grew up in Seldovia and holds a Ph.D. in geology, says he was pleasantly surprised when Times reporter Sarah Maslin Neer and photographer Stuart Isett actually showed up at their yurt to do the story.
They stayed in our guest shed. We live on the same property as my mom here, and last summer we actually salvaged an old garbage shed from the school and repurposed it into a guest shed. And it's a little 8x10. It's got a nice futon, and there are curtains on the windows and a nice little heater in there and such. But it is very small and a minimal accommodation. They did well, though.
Higman and McKittrick were already fairly well known for undertaking a year-long 7,000-mile trek from Seattle to the Aleutian Islands in 2007 and 2008. After the monumental trip, the couple ended up in Homer, where a decision on where to build a home turned into a visit to yurt salesman Peter Nagel. A year later, they lived 3 miles from Seldovia in the one-room tent-like structure. Higman says they couldn't be happier.
It's actually worked out even better than we expected. I mean, the community has been really just wonderful to become part of here. There's really a great group of people here. Our life situation has worked out really well. Work and family and social situation. Good internet connection. It's all kind of fell together just really nicely. There's nothing keeping us here other than that we like it.
And their infant son, Katmai, seems to like the minimalist lifestyle, too.
He seems pretty cool with it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a one-room house, so he gets to always be in the same room as mom and dad, and that's pretty cool. And he's cruising around now, crawling and standing up, not walking, but standing up now. And I wouldn't say the place is baby-proofed, but we semi-baby-proofed it anyway, and otherwise kind of keep track of him. And he doesn't know any better, so.
Taking advantage of their high-speed internet access, the couple is able to operate their nonprofit business, Ground Truth Trekking, and monitor sales of McKittrick's book, A Long Trek Home. Since the New York Times article, they've also used the internet phone service Skype to conduct interviews with media outlets worldwide. One of the calls came from a surprising source.
We've actually had an inquiry from the Oprah Winfrey Show, very tentative at this point, but we've talked to them a couple times.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
While many Christians in the Western world celebrated Christmas 2 weeks ago on December 25th, followers of the Russian Orthodox Church are celebrating today. From member station KDLG, Adam Kane has the story.
Russian Orthodox Christmas is traditionally celebrated by attending church many times during the week leading up to Christmas Day, On Christmas Day, members gather to celebrate, praying in English, Slavonic, and Yupik. Orthodox Christmas differs significantly from Western Christianity's version in that it doesn't end on Christmas Day. Following the service, church members sing songs together while spinning ceremonial stars. Everyone then follows the stars to the Father's house where they begin the Slavi. Slavi is the local terminology for something like caroling, where followers travel from house to house and village to village, singing songs and spinning the star. The stars are handmade wheels with five tinsel-covered spokes coming out of the center, where a picture of the Nativity is pasted. Father Larson says that the stars, which are generally made by one person in a village, are religious representations of how the stars and the sun in the sky light the world, in the same way that the Russian Orthodox believe that Christ brought light to the people.
In our church, they explain the Sun of Righteousness, the S-U-N, that how the sun lights the world. And the Son, who is Christ, when he came to this world, that he's lighting the world that who were sitting in darkness.
Members of many of the village parishes often follow their stars to other nearby villages. In rural Alaska, following the star or Slavying is not easy or cheap. Slavying typically takes place in the afternoon and goes late into the night, which is often very dark and frigid in an Alaskan winter. Also, due to the fact that there are no roads connecting villages, which can be located hundreds of miles apart, entire groups must charter airplanes in order to visit family and friends in neighboring villages. All that effort does have its benefits, however. Although gifts are not traditionally given out, a feast typically awaits the traveling choirs. Feasts can range from store-bought foods to specially preserved and prepared local berries, wild salmon, and moose. Slavying continues for 6 days and is then celebrated on the final day with one last service at church and then a large bonfire at midnight, which signifies the beginning of the Russian Orthodox New Year. Russian Orthodox is the primary sect of Christianity found in many rural Alaskan villages, originally brought to the area by Russian monks in the late 1700s. The Russian Orthodox Church is part of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is one of the three largest sects of Christianity in the world, with an estimated 300 million followers worldwide. Church traditions stem from Middle Eastern, Greek, Russian, and Slavic histories and cultures. It is generally believed that the Eastern Orthodox Church separated and developed in isolation from Christian churches found in Western Europe and the Americas sometime in the 11th or 12th centuries. In Dillingham, I'm Adam Cain.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld, Casey Kelly, and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig in Homer, and Adam Cain in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.